You've always been sort of an innovator in dental marketing. What in your mind has worked for you, and maybe what hasn't?
Marketing is just like, number one, a moving target. It's like what works today doesn't work tomorrow, and what didn't work in the past may work tomorrow. And I think the biggest thing about marketing is being patient, trying different ways to reach out. And I think also the way people take in information has changed. They don't want to be told what's out there or what to do. They want to be given information of, rather than saying, hey, you can bleach your teeth and make it, you know, 3-4 shades brighter. I think the other way to look at it is now people want to hear, if you want to bleach your teeth, here's some things you ought to know. We're the resource to find out more information about that and give people a connectivity to your office or your website to find out more information about different topics that interest them.
I see on your website, as an example, you have a lot of videos. Has that been something recent, or has that been effective for you?
That's been more recent and has been effective. But I find what's, let's say, less effective is the print ads and magazine, is direct mail. What I thought would work and has worked in the past doesn't seem to work as much anymore. So people are just a little more picky, a little more savvy, a little more skeptical, and they want to find it on their own versus be told what to do. So videos are nice.
You used to do a lot of smile makeovers, and you know the cosmetic dentistry was a big part of your practice. Isn't that correct?
Yeah.
So is it still?
It's still, but it's changed. You know, that like that book, Someone Moved My Cheese, our practice has been as high as 65% of what we do is elective dentistry, smile designs, full mouth rehabs, whitening, whatnot. And now it's about 15% of what we do is elective dentistry. And it got as low as, I think, 3 or 4% in 2009. I haven't seen days like I used to have, like in 2000, 2001. I think just coming back after the fall of the economy and after 07, things crashing, coming back up, more competition, more people doing what, you know, doing this kind of dentistry. LVI, Aesthetic Advantage, PacLive, all those programs have created a lot of great dentists who know how to do what I did. And back in 1999, 2000, I was one of few. Now I'm one of many.
Has your philosophy of dentistry changed because of this at all?
Yeah. I don't chase the big fish as much as I used to. I used to go after, with my marketing, the smile designs, the, you know, the $15,000 to $25,000 cases and up. And I used to market on airlines magazines. And I used to draw from Alaska down to Arizona, San Diego, Hawaii, and have patients come in for their treatment. But what I found is I became more and more dependent upon that kind of marketing to keep that ball rolling, where if I kind of forgot about my 10-mile radius. I forgot about my patient base I have as how well they can market for me and to reach out in that social media within the realm of just my patient base to keep things going. And so I became more dependent upon that kind of or marketing to drive that kind of patient. And then when the economy changes, that's one of the first things that people give up on is spending that kind of money. And so I've gotten back to relying on the bread and butter, posterior dentistry, direct fillings, crown and bridge. That's easy. Less stressful, easier to market for, easy to keep it going, let's say, keep that ball rolling. And I still market for larger cases, but we do a lot more internal marketing, a lot more of word of mouth within our practice and asking for referrals. And right now, about 55% of all the patients that come to our practice are simply coming from a care-to-share program of just asking for referrals. Another 15% is going to be your random word of mouth that someone just says something about us by another patient. And so really our marketing we're doing is like the last 30% is all the external marketing we're doing with print ads or magazine or direct mailing or whatnot.
Now, on your referral basis, do you have like a specific program you have in place for that?
We do. We have a thing called the Care to Share, and simply just asking patients at the end of their appointment how things go today, if it went well, ask them for referring to refer their friends in.
Where does minimally invasive dentistry come into your philosophy these days?
You know, it's always something of doing protective, preventative dentistry and sealants and things that we think commonly about minimally invasive. But in our larger cases as well, let's say our smile designs, I'm doing more and more prepless cases. Education through Dennis Wells and the program he's doing with Juan and Nelson Rico. I've learned a lot more about how can I go through and create a smile and not prep teeth. Or maybe I don't prep, and maybe it's not a non-prep for all 10 units, but definitely I'm prepping less than 10 teeth for a 10-unit smile. Maybe I'm prepping only half the teeth, or I'm doing minimally prepped and just a little bit of contouring or reshaping of the teeth to allow the veneers to be placed. And so I'm definitely doing a lot more less invasive, less cutting of tooth structure to try and get the same result that we used to get in the past where we just go through and aggressively prep all the teeth.
And how does digital dentistry play into that?
Well, when it comes, let's say, from a digital, I mean, that's a broad term. So I'm a CEREC user, and I use my Omnicam, and I scan patients' teeth, and I can communicate to my lab via digital information from either from Invisalign and orthodontics to Rego Dental Lab for my smile designs and pre-planning cases. But another side of, let's say, digital dentistry is just simply photography. And using digital smile design processes, I'm going through and imaging people's teeth and using PowerPoint and Keynote to design the case on the computer before we even get to the wax-up stage. And then I use that information to allow my ceramist to then wax up the case and or use that information in creating the ceramics.
Let's talk a little bit about what occupies your time outside of the office.
Well, I've got a 4-year-old little boy, so my life has changed a bit. I have a 24-year-old, a 21-year-old, and a 4-year-old, three boys. It's fun being a dad a second time around in a way, and I'm really enjoying it, and I'm in a different place in my life where I can just have more fun with it. And then I love to golf. Golf was one of my passions. I happen to live in Seattle where it rains a lot, especially October through May, and it's it can get gray and just kind of gloomy. And so my wife and I made a change about 3 years ago. Well, we ended up buying a place in North Scottsdale. And so mid-October to end of April, early May, we leave every third weekend. So we have something to look forward to and have a Wednesday through Sunday weekend or longer weekend and go someplace where it's sunny and warm. And we love to play golf and play tennis.
That's a beautiful area. Some wonderful golf courses up there. What's your handicap now?
I'm a 3.
And what do you recommend for the guy that wants to become a golfer?
Juan Nelson turned me on to this, and it's called K-Vest, capital K-V-E-S-T, like a vest you wear. Of all the golf lessons I've taken over the past, let's say, 7-8 years, I've done this for the past 2 years, and it's made the biggest change in my game in the way I learn and the way I deal with my golf swing and with the whole golfing. And it's about kinetic sequencing. It's about learning how to snap a towel, how to crack a whip. It's a really cool way of using motion sensors and where things aren't spaced to have a teacher look at a computer screen and get feedback that way about what your body's doing and teach you from there.
If you were going to recommend the best course you ever played on to the audience, what would it be?
Oh, I love Pebble Beach. I love the location. I love the view, the scenery. It's a pretty neat place.
Are you involved with any other businesses, Mike, other than the practice?
Yeah, actually, I've gotten fed up with the stock market and trying to pick the right horse or right stock or right mutual fund, and I've gotten more involved in apartments. And we've gotten involved in trying to find 25 to 30 unit apartment complexes that make the right price, that makes sense, and get involved with that and buy those and hang on to those. Yeah, I've been doing that kind of investing in real estate. I find that to be a lot more predictable.
You're quite the wine expert.
Well, I like wine.
What kind of wines do you like?
If we're talking brands, you know, a good dental one is Pride. Jim Pride, rest his soul, he started a great winery, and he's on the peak of a mountain that kind of divides Sonoma and Napa County, and that's a great winery to go visit. I like Dariush. I like Quilcita. Happens to be, I'm in the Northwest in Seattle. Patients of mine, Jeannie and Paul Gallitzin, they happen to own Quilcita Creek. Quilcita Creek happens to be the only wine at this point that ever got a 100-point rated wine in the world. But I would say from wines, what I've learned and a good friend told me once was, think about how many bottles of wine you drink a year. And wouldn't it be nice if every time you opened a bottle of wine, it was a 10-year-old bottle or plus of Cab. So his suggestion to me was, you know, if you only need 50 bottles a year, then why not go ahead and buy those 50 bottles from wineries you like and store them and save them. And I took it to heart and did that. And in Seattle, we have, like you have public storage in areas. We happen to have public wine storage that has lockers that can hold 20, 30, 40, 50 cases. So I don't have a big wine storage in my house. I happen to have a wine fridge from Costco that holds a couple hundred bottles of wine. But I have lockers, and I just started putting wine away back in 2000, and actually 1999, and buying a case here, a case there, and storing it. And it's, if it's out of sight, out of mind, I can't get to it. It's a few miles away from home. I don't cheat and open early. And so then back in, let's say, 2012, 2013, it's time. I now have 10-year-old bottles of Cab, and I started pulling it out. And so now I just try to drink those 10-year-old bottles or more and enjoy my Cab that way or my wine that way.
What makes a good Cab for you, Cabernet for you?
Oh, I just like a really smooth, actually, I would say my blends are my favorite. My favorite wine that I've had lately has been Insignia. And it's a blend of a Cab Franc. I just like a nice smooth wine.
What would surprise people that they don't know about you?
You know, I think nothing comes easy, and I had some success in my practice and success in lecturing and success in dentistry from that standpoint through the AACD or teaching, PacLive, LVI. And I would say it this way, though. I didn't invent anything. I didn't create anything special, but I'm really good at listening to other people and copying them. I look at someone like a Ron Jackson and Bill Dickerson and people that have created something and Rosenthal and innovators. I've been successful at teaching because I copy people like those people. I think I've got pretty good hand skills, but what I'm really good at is paying attention, recognizing a good idea, and saying, I'm going to copy that and stick with it. Like the Borg in Star Trek, I've kind of traveled around the country and picked up all these good ideas. I think I've got a really good practice because I recognize good ideas, and I stick with them, and I implement them.
So anything jump out at you as the thing that you've copied or found that was most successful for you?
I would say the way I do an aesthetic case, the sequencing I do and the tools I use is very successful, very predictable. I have a very simple way of going through and doing a 10-unit veneer case that's helpful and makes it a real simple way to go through the process. And I think people can make it so challenging. It doesn't need to be. And I would say the other thing I've learned from people is monitoring what you do. Using spreadsheets to track your practice, to track certain parameters, certain numbers, and then come back and compare a trend. I don't worry too much about what happened today, numbers-wise. I note it, but I care more about what happened for the past week, the past month, the past 4 months. I look at trends. There's good days, there's bad days, but I want to see what's happening for the past month or two. How are things going that way, comparing it how we did a year ago, how we have done for the past 5 years, things like that. So I try not to sweat the small stuff and the micro details. I do want to look at the bigger picture and trends.
Do you track procedures as well?
Some I do, but more so just the financial, what are we doing? There's two things I've tracked that people might find interesting is that track the number of crowns you prep a day and track the number of crowns you diagnose a day. The ones you prep may not be the ones you diagnose that day. Sometimes it happens, but rarely. It's just how many did I diagnose today and how many did I prep today, and just keep that tally going. And you'll find typically for every 10 crowns you diagnose, 7 to 8 will happen, and 2 to 3 won't because patients either financial and choose not to, they leave your practice, they move on, whatever reasons, doesn't happen. And so if I know my practice needs to survive on doing, let's say, 7 units of crown or bridge a day, I'm going to diagnose 10. And if I'm not going to make up a diagnosis, but if I need more bodies, more exams to be done, I need more new patients, I've got to keep that number where I at least have put 10 shots at the goal, and I hope I'll score 7 times. And if that gap widens, if I'm diagnosing 10 and I'm only prepping 4, you got to wonder, okay, have things changed in the economy? Have things changed in my case presentation skills? What's happening in my team, my dynamic, that number is spread apart? And ultimately, what the bottom line is, I want to be doing 7 units a day. You can look the same way when it comes to smile designs from elective cases, 10-unit veneer cases or more. We track actually 8 units or more that are elective dentistry. And that's a different dynamic. I know for every 4 times I diagnose a case, 1 will happen and 3 do not. And I also know then if I want to do 1 smile design a week, I've got to present 4 cases in that week. And to present 4 cases, I've maybe talked to 3 or 4 people before they say yes, they want to hear about a case presentation, a consult with them. So it means that we've got to talk to about 4 patients a day to boil down to 1 a day who wants to hear about it, to boil down 4 in a week that heard about it, to boil down to 1 case that actually happens.
So last question. So if you knew then what you know now about life, what would you change?
I'd be more diligent about saving for tomorrow. I'd spend less time in the stock market, more time in real estate, and I would avoid things to get myself in big debt. If you can't float when the economy goes bad or income goes bad, then don't buy it. Debt is a bad thing. Interest payments kill you.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.